Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, spread, totals, player props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
I'm Commander Shepard, and this is my favorite lore cast on the Citadel.
Welcome to the Mass Effect lore cast. I'm N7 the Legend.
And I'm Genesis. Join us
as we explore along tides of light
and through shoals of dust
to see where this lore began
and consider where it may go.
Spectres, so welcome back to the Mass Effect Lorecast, the show where the FCC and Disney cannot tell us what to say. And joining me, as always, is Genesis. Genesis, how are you doing?
Very uncensored.
Uncensored, unbothered, flourishing in our lane, and we have a great lore episode for everyone today.
Yes.
Yeah, so...
I like that, staying in the lane. I'm just doing me.
Yeah, exactly. We're living our lives. I'm not even going to say best lives. I'm just going to say lives. So we've been teasing this episode for a hot minute. Paul Grayson, we're finally here, and this is a name that a lot of players may be familiar with. And if you're not, don't beat yourself up, because this is not a character from any of the games in the original trilogy or Andromeda. In fact, I don't think he's even mentioned in the trilogy, right?
I don't think so. I think Grayson might be book exclusive.
Yes, he's a Cerberus agent. He's introduced in the novels, specifically in Mass Effect Ascension. That's the second of the trilogy of novels by Mass Effect 1's lead writer, Drew Karpyshyn. And so Paul is somewhat of an anti-hero. And I'll say somewhat, because it's a bit more complicated than that. And we'll talk through this over the next two episodes, because this is going to be our part one. We're going to have a part two as well. And we're going to dive into a lot of what makes Paul Grayson tick. Now, we're not going to go page by page and, you know, like read you everything that he's involved in. If you really want to read the books, you should go read them. They're great. Well, they're also very, very great to listen to on audiobook. I thought the narrator did a great job.
For the most part, yeah, there were a couple of things that really stick out to me in the audiobook version, which I do fully enjoy. But it's Kaylee Sanders, not Kali, and it's Quarian. They are the Quarians, not the Quarians. The Quarians? Quarians, I think he said a couple of times, and I was just like, the Quarians. It's little things like that that'll stick out to me.
The Quarians. All right. Well, so a little background for everybody. I have read this book and listened to the audiobook, but it was like more than, I want to say like about 2 years ago. Whereas Genesis, you just finished the audiobook, like re-listening to it for a second time, like today, right?
Yeah, I had an hour left to go through for today. But yes, it's not my first time going through it. I read it again. It was like a couple years ago that I read through it the first time. And I was like, I just want a full refresh. And it's a 9-hour audiobook. Very easy to get through in a day.
So before we go any further, let's talk about what Grayson physically looks like, since we don't have an artistic representation of him in the games. He is described as being tall, dark-haired, and handsome. And I want to say handsome with a question mark, because it never says he's handsome, right? But it says it uses other language to describe him, where you're kind of led to believe that he's good looking.
Yeah, I think it's more of a nondescript good looking. They didn't really put a major face to him. I have seen it that they think the cover of Ascension is supposed to be him. And in that case, that guy's kind of handsome, but he's also got a lot of like cybernetics and gear coming off of his face, which is not described at all in the book for Grayson. So I don't think it's him.
Well, I think you're referencing the cover of Retribution, in which case it very well could be him. But we will get to why that's the case a little bit later. I don't want to spoil anything for anyone. There's a character flaw that is so critical to understanding Paul Grayson. And it is his ongoing addiction with Red Sand. He is so deep in the throes of addiction that he is visibly addicted. This Red Sand addiction, like we hear in the games, he has these bloodshot eyes, almost terminally, and his teeth are all discolored, which both of those symptoms sound like these typical things that happen to hard drug users.
Absolutely, yeah. That, and it's described as he'll sometimes be shaky or not focusing while in the middle of conversations. But I also wanted to point out that it's not like your standard discoloration of the teeth. You can actually see them glowing. It's almost like they have a biotic sheen about them.
Wow. Okay, so that is very unique. That is, can you imagine seeing someone who's like clearly strung out, and for all intents and purposes, they look like they might be addicted to drugs, except their smile is like a radioactive Colgate commercial.
Exactly. That's a very weird dynamic going on there. But then again, very unique and very Mass Effect.
9 out of 10 dentists recommend Red Sand. Don't trust those dentists. Especially if they're employed by... Never mind. So the withdrawal periods really take a toll on Grayson. And we get some pretty vivid imagery written in the books about this, right, Jen?
Mm-hmm. We do. And it seems like in the beginning parts of the book, anything over like 24 hours of him not taking Red Sand gets him into this withdrawal phase where... he is sweating, and it sounds almost like any standard drug withdrawal. You get shaking and sweating, and you get cramps in your muscles, and just that addiction voice in your head going, you need another hit, you need to take another line. Red Sand, they describe it as it's a powder that you snort like you would cocaine.
Right. And of course, the main draw of taking this drug to a lot of people isn't just a sense of euphoria, but it's also it gives non-biotics users a little taste of what it's like to have biotics. They can use telekinesis to basically manipulate very small items. It doesn't make them a biotic god. Like Niftu Cal says, although we're led to believe that he is a Red Sand addict.
Right. And I think Grayson just does it enough to get that initial euphoria and the small level of biotic use. In one scene, he is high and he talks about floating paper around his room and being able to control it. And then the giddy and the joy that you get from using your biotics. Caden and Liara and Jacob all talk about this humming, this frenetic energy that they feel within their body when they're using biotics. And so that is part of what this drug replicates for people who are non-biotics.
And part of the reason is because Ezo is involved in its production. Like, it's made from Ezo, right? And I believe it was first made on Mars. So that could be a possible source of that name, Red Sand. But as far as Grayson goes, like any addict, we see in the book that he's trying to walk this tightrope of not letting his addiction affect his work or what little personal life he has. But it's not like the elusive man doesn't know that he is addicted to red sand.
Right. You can tell. And the elusive man definitely knows. You just got to look at the guy and you know you're on something.
You can't hide it, basically. Red sand is one of those drugs that you really can't hide your addiction to. But for Paul, that means that he's often thinking about his next hit. He's basically making these mental roadmaps about, you know, when and where he's going to arrange it in private. And I always noticed that was interesting in the books, that he is going to great lengths when he does get high, that he's going to do it in private. And so we get this insight that Grayson is ashamed of his drug usage.
Correct. Ashamed of it and not in the full throes of addiction yet. Yes, he is addicted, but he's a functioning addict. He's not, you know, just sitting. Yeah. I mean, he still gets the job done. Right. He's not fully functioning, but he definitely still does everything that he's supposed to be doing and just wants to keep this aspect of his life hidden as much as he can.
And so I feel like he is in what I would call and what I've heard other people call the maintenance phase of addiction, where he is purely just taking the drug so that his withdrawal stays at bay. But he's also seeking the hits. So it's not like, you know, like we said, this is a character flaw that repeatedly appears over and over in his story. And it has this profound impact on how he acts. And it's also kind of this theme that alludes to his ongoing moral quandaries with his work for Cerberus.
Yeah, it plays a huge part in it. You know, addiction plays a huge part in all aspects of life.
And this also means, in terms of his work for Cerberus, that he's essentially compromised from the very start, which one might think that the elusive man would have a problem with one of his agents that's doing wet work, that he would have a problem with them being compromised, being open to being blackmailed. But then again, this gives the elusive man extraordinary leverage over Grayson.
Mm-hmm. Because he could probably block the routes of red sand to him or use it as a control factor. I will hook you up with better distributors, even more and higher quality. But speaking of that, how does the relationship with Grayson and Cerberus start out?
Right. So Grayson is a field operative for Cerberus. He is not this guy that's sitting in a lab like those scientists that we meet on some Uncharted Worlds in Mass Effect 1. Out of the gate, he is doing wet work for the elusive man, specifically sabotage and assassination missions. So there are two key moments that really shape Grayson's involvement with Cerberus. Number one, you remember when we talked about the Eltveld Ashland Energy Company and the conspiracy about Cerberus blowing up ships over the planet Yondoa to intentionally expose pregnant women to Ezo dust.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about that. I don't know what number episode that was. I believe Tom was actually my co-host at that point, but we've talked about it since then. And that was Grayson. Grayson was the Cerberus agent involved in that. So around 2170, he sabotaged that Eldfell Ashland energy ship that was in orbit. And lo and behold, the Ezo dust did fall, or it was in the atmosphere, and it did fall onto the surface of Yondoa, and it created some biotics. Now, it left many more children, or I should say fetuses, dead. And if the children were born, they were born with defects or cancers. But 37 children were relatively healthy after being born, and they did develop biotic abilities. One of those 37 children was named Jillian, and she was later kidnapped by Cerberus and then, quote unquote, given to Paul Grayson. Now, this is how it's described in the book, that she was given to Paul Grace. I never liked that description that you could give a human being to someone else.
Yeah, that's not a gift. You know, this, they didn't go through an adoption agency. They didn't go through any shape or form of that. And it's also, we're saying children, that one of the children was Jillian. No, she's still pretty much a baby at this point, well under a year old. Because in, while they were describing this scene, is that the elusive man was holding the baby. And that just, like, that set panic in my own body. I can't think of the elusive man holding a baby. That picture should not exist.
I would never trust him to hold my son. She was kidnapped and then trafficked, essentially, by Cerberus. And the elusive man hands her to Paul Grayson and tasks him with raising her as if he was her father. Like, this is a long con, deep cover thing that he's doing. And the intention is to make her this long-term case study in human potential of biotics.
Yeah. It's horrendous and brings up so many ethical questions surrounding this. Not only the kidnapping, the trafficking. Why does Paul just agree to the fact of, oh, you're handing me a random baby? Sure, I'll take care of it. Where did Grayson get the skills to take care of a newborn baby without a mother around? You know, who is influencing this child? And it just, there's a lot of things that I don't, that are unanswered, that I don't like about this.
Yeah, a lot of factors going into that completely unethical mission, I should say. None of which are the welfare of Jillian. And I'm sure that the elusive man would say that this is for her welfare and it's for the welfare of all human beings, right? The advancement of humanity. And yet, this is a huge lie that is, of course, going to change Jillian's entire life. You know, like, if Cerberus had never have meddled, she wouldn't have developed biotics. She would probably still be with her family. Her life would be incredibly different. And yet now we have this Cerberus wet work agent who's been involved in sabotage and assassinations, being her adoptive father. And it's not one of those, like that funny, like, Vin Diesel movie where he plays the babysitter. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? It's not like one of those movies that's like, oh, the incredibly deadly spy is now playing, you know, the babysitter. No, it's not like that. Because he's still working for Cerberus.
Yeah.
So he's still working for Cerberus this whole time, and this is part of his job. That's the first moment that really changes Paul Grayson. The second one is 3 years later. It's the night of his first kill. And we get this in one of the opening scenes of Mass Effect Ascension, where Paul Grayson is having this nightmare of remembering the first kill. So in 2173, he was on this undercover mission to take out a leading candidate for leadership of the Terra Firma Party. That's that human supremacist political party trying to gain more power in galactic politics. The candidate's name was Claude Monod. But the problem was, Claude Monod was leading another candidate, Charles Saraceno, in the polls. That name should ring a bell to everyone who's played Mass Effect 1. I don't think Saraceno appears in Mass Effect 2. Does he?
No, because no matter the outcome of that, he won't show up in 2.
Right. It's a chance encounter on the near the med bay in the wards, right, of Mass Effect 1 on the Citadel. So Claude Monod is actually leading Charles Saraceno in those polls for leadership of the Terra Firma Party. But the problem was that the elusive man didn't like Monod and preferred that Saraceno be in charge. So the elusive man ordered Monod to be disappeared.
Yes, quote, quote, disappeared.
Yeah, quote, unquote, and disappeared.
Yeah,
I'm sure that the elusive man had his altruistic reasons, right? So Grayson and his partner Pell are acting as Minot's flight crew. They're undercover again. They're acting as the flight crew to take Minot to Shanxi for a rally. And they went mask off after the bird was in the air, or space, so to speak. So the ship is flying through space. Grayson and Pell take the mask off. Grayson kills Minot's bodyguard. And Pell walks into the cabin and kills Minot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not a clean kill. And he does have some hesitancy about it in the beginning, but then completely follows through with the orders. Once he hears his trigger phrase, he is on and makes his first kill.
And this is something that dehumanizes Grayson, which makes him more susceptible to taking more orders from the elusive man.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, even a decade later, he's still haunted by this. The reason that we find out about his first kill and the night that Jillian was brought to him is because these are his reoccurring dreams. And it's something that is always on his mind. He prefers the Minot dream rather than the Jillian dream, because the Jillian dream makes him feel sad, makes him feel, it brings like the sadder emotions that he can't be with his quote daughter. And I thought that part of it was interesting as well, that he would rather dream of somebody, of killing somebody, rather than having to deal with the hard emotions that involve Jillian.
Right. Well, it shows that he has some kind of conscience, though that conscience is twisted and distorted by what he's asked to do for Cerberus for so long.
I also really want to know, Jillian at this point is 3 years old. Where is she? Who is she with?
Great question.
My daddy's out murdering people. Who am I staying with?
Oh, he's just on a business trip. Honey, your daddy will be back soon. I'm guessing that they found some kind of galactic daycare.
Cerberus daycare.
Ooh.
I don't want to know.
Yikes. I'm sure that they have a great snack machine and plenty of outdoor time.
Yeah, outdoor time or tablet time. Learn all these great things, children. Propaganda, propaganda.
They have a shooting range for children and all the targets are aliens.
Oh, no.
Yeah, right. And Yukon Cornelius in chat here says, that's Miranda's first assignment, babysitting. I think that timeline might line up. But isn't she like 40-something or 50-something in Mass Effect 2?
Yeah, I think so. She's in her early 40s, I want to say.
Yeah, she's much older than you'd think because of her genes. But yeah, that timeline might add up. So this isn't exactly, the elusive man isn't just planning on having Grayson be Mr. Dad. And that's that.
Right. He has much bigger plans for Jillian. So let's talk about this total game plan for Jillian and her burgeoning biotic abilities.
Yeah. She's not kept it as this lab rat either aboard some Cerberus station. But Cerberus does have Grayson pose as her father so that he can enlist her in the Alliance's Gifted Biotic Students Academy. That's named the Ascension Project. His cover story is that he is this single widower and a very important businessman from Cord Hislop Aerospace. Sounds like the beginning to like a Hallmark Christmas movie.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Dad's all important in his big corporate world, and here I am trying to be the best at my biotics.
I'm at my biotic talent show, and where's my dad on an important business trip murdering people?
Horrible. But so, I would totally watch it.
So if Cord Hislop Aerospace sounds familiar to you, it's because the Elusive Man is not incredibly original in the names of his shell companies. It in itself is another lie, because Cord Hislop Aerospace is a shell company for Cerberus. Cord Hislop refers to Eva Corre and Ben Hislop, his two companions, on the Mass Effect Evolution comic from way back when he was known as Jack, and he was going, I can't remember the Elusive Man's original last name. Jack
Harper.
That's right. Jack Harper, when he was known as Jack Harper as a mercenary, and he was on Shanxi, and he stumbled onto this conspiracy involving Saren and Saren's brother, and yada, yada, yada. Anyway, we covered that in a different episode. Court Hislop is a reference to Corey and Hislop's, so he clearly cannot let that go.
Well, yeah, no, he can't let Eva Corey go. I mean, that's why she exists again, but we've talked about Edie before for sure, so...
Yeah, I can never get enough Edie. So Jillian is being taught how to harness her powers in this Ascension project. And meanwhile, Grayson is playing the loving but busy and distant father who occasionally checks in. And somehow no one really catches on to what he really does. I don't know. Do you remember any kind of tense conversations where someone's questioning him about that?
Yeah, that definitely happens with one, the main security officer, but I think that we can definitely get into that side of the story of how much Henkel does not like Grayson after the mid-break.
That's right. All right, let's go to the mid-break.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
We have beef, we have bacon, we have beer. The foods of my people.
Young men have funny ideas of what Asari are like. I blame the extranet and computer games.
Rex?
Shepard.
Grunt?
Shepard.
Rex? Grunt?
All right, here we are in the middle of the show where we typically read out your 5-star reviews. Now, I just checked yesterday, and I'll check again, but I don't believe we have any new 5-star reviews, not now on Apple Podcasts, and I haven't noticed any new comments on Spotify from our most recent episode, but we do have a couple of comments that I want to highlight from our YouTube channel. So, Dorothy App, I hope I said that right. Says, when I read through the casting list, referring to the Mass Effect TV show, casting colleagues, when I read through the casting list, my intuition said it's post Mass Effect 3. If that Asari is Liara, she should be younger than the given age, like 20 something looking, if it would be a retelling of the trilogy. The wrestler type guy instantly put James Vega in my mind. Maybe we can see him as a proven in 7. But it's just a rumor, so we shall see. At least we have something to talk about until in 7 day. And I hope they'll give us a new story with new characters that bridges the trilogy and Mass Effect Andromeda and Mass Effect 5. I would tend to agree with all of that. Yeah, if it is Liara, like original trilogy Liara does look like, you know, a human, like if a human woman would have to be in her 20s.
Yeah. I agree on that one.
And the casting call specifically said a woman in her 30s. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's so much speculation and so many things that we're not going to have answered for a really long time. So it could also just be the fact that so many people within the Mass Effect fandom have complained that Liara seems far too young in the first game that they're like, all right, people bitch about this all the time. Let's age her up a little bit.
Right. Maybe. Yeah, maybe. And especially with how mature she would have to act, they would want someone who does look a little older, maybe. I don't know. We also have another comment from, I hope I'm pronouncing this one right, Limalepeco, that says, This thumbnail gave me psychic damage. The thumbnail for our Amazon casting call episode. That's good. That was my direct work. And that was the point. I was trying to give everyone psychic damage. A little behind baseball. YouTube only rewards videos that play into a grocery store tabloid kind of algorithm. And so I'm hoping the long form content is at least good and in-depth enough that it would justify sensationalized thumbnails.
Yeah, I'm all for it. You have great ideas when it comes to throwing together all these pictures, and they are not clickbait, because normally the title says something crazy, but then we give you the actual, real, good information.
Yeah, and we get into the crazy. So speaking of crazy, I've got this crazy voice line for Genesis. Okay, it's not that crazy, but I'll be very surprised if you get this one. Okay, are you ready?
All right.
Here we go.
Even if you survive the battle today, the Reapers won't stop. Ever. Release me and we have a chance to end this once and for all.
All right.
Well, that was obviously Commander Broshep.
Mm-hmm. Which game?
Down in kind of ME3. I'm going to listen to it one more time.
All right, here, I'll play it one more time on my side as well so people can hear it again.
Even if you survive the battle today, the Reapers won't stop. Ever. Release me and we have a chance to end this once and for all.
All right, any guesses?
I want to say something to do with the Quarian missions in ME3. I can't place it exactly, though. Oh,
it's a tough one. It's a tough one because it's so generic. But it is Broshep. It is Mass Effect 3. However, it is during the Leviathan DLC.
Oh, Leviathan. I have only been able to play you twice.
What?
Damn.
That is my favorite DLC.
I didn't get Leviathan until I got Legendary.
Okay, fair. It is my favorite DLC. It should have been part of the base game. With the massive lore implication, not just implications, with the massive lore statements from that DLC, it's insane to me that it was a paywalled.
Yes, and now that I'm thinking about it, release me and we can fight the Reapers together. Yes, that is definitely something that is said while under the water.
All right. Well, I got her. I finally got her. We don't have any new patrons this week, but we do have our Tier 5 patrons who have continuously, graciously supported this show. That's Butts, 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 Unfortunate Benefactor, William, Superfly 440, Retrobot, Lieutenant Tosino, Curacy, and Ed Boy.
After time adrift among open stars, along tides of light and through shoals of dust, I will return to where I began.
Solarian reproduction different, very little sex drive. If intended to try human, would try you.
Ow, my pancreas.
And we're back with the second half of the show.
Yes, yes, we are. All right, so we kind of left it off to where now Jillian has been at this Ascension program, and we're going to talk about how Grayson's story plays out through the rest of the book, because this is where it gets kind of interesting. We've built up his character so far, what he's like, and now it goes to where do all these story points join together. Now, throughout this whole story, it feels to me like Grayson genuinely cares for Jillian, but also holds a sense of loyalty to Cerberus. And it isn't until a conversation while Paul is still a little high that he's questioning if his loyalty is actually still to the elusive man or if it's to Jillian.
Which is interesting that he would mentally pit them against each other. That something must be happening where at least subconsciously Paul is realizing that he can either be a good Cerberus agent or a good father.
Right. Because Grayson tells the elusive man that Jillian has had a violent reaction to the new biotic enhancement drugs that Cerberus has secretly been giving her for the past few years. And it's his paranoia from the red sand that makes him see the elusive man's calculated words, his perfected empathetic responses, and his modulated tone of voice. Now, the elusive man tells him to play the role of the freaked out parent and to pull Jillian out of her ascension training and back into the warm embraces of Cerberus.
Which, this part is so, like, messed up. Let's back up for a second. So, Jillian has been part of this Alliance youth biotic program, the Ascension Project. And while this is on a completely secure Alliance facility, it's essentially a school. And being her father, Paul is entitled to these visits every now and then. And he's not the only Cerberus agent involved in this, but they have been sneaking drugs onto the Alliance or the Ascension Project, knowing that there are the correct medical professionals and scientists there to rectify anything if they mess up. And it's Cerberus drugs. It's not like these are FDA approved.
Right. And the fact this violent reaction happens because Cerberus changed the formula. They are usually always tweaking it a little bit to see if they can spark Jillian to have more biotic abilities. But even Grayson and his on-site contact say that this formula looks a lot different than what they had been administering.
But still, like, even though Grayson feels an obligation to Jillian, he's still complicit in dosing a woman who he says is his daughter. Like, he's dosing her over and over and over again. And for what reason? It's not for her own welfare.
No.
It's purely to get biotic results.
Yeah, there is the little bit of cognitive dissonance that you can play the card of, oh, it's not me actually giving her the drugs. It's Jiro, this other doctor, who's actually the one doing it. So I'm not causing her harm. It's just Jiro is following his orders from the elusive man. My order is only to bring it to him.
That's a classic trolley problem right there. But I personally think that this cognitive dissonance is fueling his addiction.
Oh, okay. Yeah, definitely. I think we can definitely analyze that with why he uses the red sand.
It puts him under a lot of stress, but sorry, go on.
It does put him under a lot of stress. And, you know, pulling your kid out of school, it can be tough and it can make him want to use for sure. But in the case where your child, quote, quote, is a gifted biotic that so many people want to either help or harness, it makes it that much more difficult.
Right. She's just tossed around from place to place. And it's not like he knows that pulling her out of the Alliance oversight, like, and back to Cerberus, it's not like Cerberus is going to be friendlier. And he probably feels weird, because if Cerberus is going to be rougher with her, how much bandwidth does he have to speak up to the elusive man to tell him to stop?
At this point, none. Like, he's doing all this because he wants to be loyal to the elusive man. He's like, all right, I will give her the drugs. You know, you gave me this child so that way I could raise it to get her into a program like this. And so that way we can better all of humanity by increasing biotics to a new level. But doing it under the Ascension program means that she'll get the proper training, because the elusive man doesn't have a lot of human biotics that would be capable of training somebody like this.
Yeah, exactly.
So Grayson makes his way back to the Ascension program to let the school know that after this violent reaction that Jillian, for some unknown reason to the school, has had, she creates a singularity. She's shown very little biotic potential. She's shown a massive amount of biotic potential, but had yet to actually produce anything biotically until this new drug that the Cerberus agents had given her. And so Grayson acts like the freaked out parent and goes back onto the station and meets with Kaylee Sanders. Yes, yes, that Kaylee. And Hendel, the main security officer and a former bot student.
That's the brain camp that Caden went to.
Mm-hmm. So Hendel and Caden might have been hanging out at some point because it was a very short run program. And they say that they want to join Grayson to help get Jillian to safety. Now, Jillian needs to be extracted because the Hendel and Kaylee found out about Jiro being a Cerberus agent. So now Grayson's freaking out, going, oh no, we need to get Jillian out of here. She's being hunted by Cerberus. And so these two people who genuinely also care about Jillian say, we want to help. Let's go.
And I think that they really called Grayson's bluff here. Like, Kaylee, throughout this book, as much as I don't like it, is kind of like painted as this like, oh, like this airhead who doesn't really see what's going on. But Hendel knows. Hendel knows that something's up with Grayson and has reasonable suspicion even before learning that Jiro was a mole, a plant, mm-hmm. rather. And now, you know, Grayson all of a sudden is wanting to pull his daughter out. And I think Hendel knows what's going on, is like, yeah, I want to keep my eyes on you. But Kaylee just genuinely cares about Jillian. And by the way, all of this is even more complicated because Kaylee was sleeping with Jiro.
Yeah, there's that aspect to it too. It's quite interesting, the little triangle that's going on here. But Hendel definitely thinks that he 99% suspects that Grayson is on Red Sand. Kaylee is wearing the rose-colored glasses and doesn't want to see it. That's just a stressed out parent. You have no idea what stress he's under. It's okay. Let me go sleep with another associate who's 20 years my junior. Oh, it's interesting for sure on that aspect. But they do. And they all care about Jillian and they all want to get her off of the space station. Grayson, because he wants to give her back to the elusive man. Kaylee, because she cares. And then Hendel, just to make sure that Jillian actually gets the biotic training that she needs. And with these other people around him, he has to fully play the role of the distraught parent and not that of the Cerberus operative extracting a high-value target.
Which might not be too hard for him because Grayson only thinks he's playing the parent. When in reality, at this point, he's playing a Cerberus agent. we were talking about this yesterday when we were formulating the notes for this episode, the whole trope of like, they fell for the mark. Right. Mm-hmm. But Grayson, It's not like a romantic relationship. It's a parental relationship. So something that was supposed to just be, this is just strictly business, he actually ends up like falling into a paternal figure responsibility role for Jillian. And so playing the role of the distraught parent, I think, is not that much of a stretch because he's more of a distraught parent than he is a Cerberus agent at this point.
I fully agree. And we really start to see that when there are little moments between Grayson and Jillian that melt my mama heart. And I can tell in the book that it's also melting Grayson, truly falling for his daughter, like showing an actual parental fatherly love for somebody that I assume in their childhood growing up was very distant. And now getting some of these interactions that he wasn't expecting.
Right. So where do they end up going?
So Grayson thinks that Omega is the best place to hide. And in my opinion, that is a pretty good place to dodge the council, but not necessarily Cerberus.
And horrible choice, Grayson.
Yeah. Not very good. There are a few major plot points and a lot of characters that we could get into, but you really got to go read this book for yourself because there's some drama, there is the intrigue, and there's a really good fight scene in it too. But it ends with Grayson, Jillian, Kaylee, Hendel, and a Quarian named Lem get to escape to the migrant fleet.
But before then, we do learn that Grayson's old partner, Pell, the one who helped him carry out his first kill, Pell betrays Grayson. And you would think that Grayson might have expected this, or that it would at least have be leaving Grayson with even more trust issues than he already had. But it seems like he never really trusted Pell to begin with.
Yeah, but Pell was supposed to be his Omega contact because Pell was supposedly still a part of Cerberus. And so that's why he was going to Pell in order to be like, okay, let's get her off of Omega and to wherever the elusive man says to go to next.
Right, but then there was the crisscross. And we should also mention that Kaylee and Hendel and Jillian, they all get to the fleet, and specifically the ship, the Idina, separately from Grayson. Grayson is left behind on Omega, and he thinks that Jillian has been taken, like, by the Quarians. So he begs the elusive man to let him lead this A-team to go rescue his daughter. And I say rescue loosely, because it's like, well, where is she ultimately going, even after you get her?
There's one other character that we can talk about for just a minute, and that's Golo. Because Golo, he's the Quarian turncoat that before all of this happened was exiled from the fleet. Now, he helps Grayson and the team of Cerberus troops to infiltrate the fleet. So if you were wondering how Cerberus even knows the fleet's current location or is able to carry out the attack on such a short notice, you can blame Golo. And a little bit of Pell. He straight up brutally tortured a captured Quarian from the Idena to get his coordinates and his passphrase. And which, side note, though my body may travel, my soul is with the fleet, is also a really good passphrase.
Oh my god, these passphrases are some of my favorite prose in the entire series, like even extended media of Mass Effect. I love it. But yeah, so this is something that in terms of lore implications is massive because there has never been another species militarized branch or paramilitary organization, that has been able to infiltrate the fleet before.
Yeah, they've never made it onto the flotilla, onto an individual ship that's not been a part of the fleet at that time. But never with all the ships together.
And we also know that, like, the fleet is incredibly insular and protective about who's allowed on board, you know, because their resources are quite slim. And any outsider might bring with them the chance of bringing in unknown variables, all of which could gravely endanger the Quarian population, all of whom have a job, and a very important job at that.
All right. But back to Grayson. He reaches out to the only person that he thinks can save Jillian. And he has a rare face-to-face meeting with the elusive man. Now, he convinces Timmy Boy to do an extraction from the fleet, which in itself is a huge ask, but he also wants to be part of that A team that you mentioned. But Tim, like, I don't know why, but he eventually agrees. The only thing that I can think of is that shows how much he wants Jillian back under Cerberus control. If he's willing to risk resources, exposure, and all of this just to save one 12-year-old girl.
I think it also, for the elusive man, if I'm the elusive man, I'm thinking this could be a good test case to see how well defended the fleet is. Obviously, he doesn't care for the Quarian's welfare, and I think that he could be using it as an opportunity to test boundaries, much like we see those Russian fighter jets just regularly violating Alaskan airspace or NATO airspace. And it's almost like they're gauging response times to test boundaries. I think that could be an ulterior motive for agreeing, because the elusive man is nothing if not pragmatic, and he's not sentimental. So, of course, Jillian is a high value target to him. At the same time, I think he also realizes that he can kill two birds with one stone by sending an extraction team to exfiltrate her.
I like that a lot, because we all know that the elusive man plays 4D chess and is always thinking three layers deep, and doing this for multiple reasons makes more sense to me. Now, eventually Grayson does get onto the fleet, and we see these are the moments where he really has to confront his conflicting loyalties of either to the elusive man or to Jillian.
Yes. And it's kind of like you can feel him sweating bullets during these moments. And during these moments, he's being walked around the ship because, again, I'm sorry. Am I skipping ahead?
So Grayson is never like fully being walked around the ship. The Jillian, Kaylee, and Hendel are the ones who get to explore the Idena.
So that this sequence of events is happening simultaneously. And so we get a lot of depictions of how the Quarians are living in squalor, even aboard their own vessels. And I think Yukon Cornelius here must have access to our notes, because he brought it up like a minute before we did. Basically we see that they are living in these super close quarters. They're essentially living in office cubicles, like whole families are. And the walls are decorated with photos and memorabilia and these things that hold sentimental value to them. But it looks like a floating refugee camp.
Yeah, I also really liked the way that there's no bartering system. There's no money in the flotilla. If you have an excess of something, you put it in a locker in the central area. And then if I'm looking for something that I need, I go to the lockers and see if anybody has left one there. Because I no longer need this, I leave it here. I need this to take with me back to my family. And it's not a value system. It is purely, I only take what I need. And I was like, that's really interesting.
It is really interesting. It's completely dependent on the honor system. But it's also like, the honor system has this sword of Damocles hanging above its head, because everyone really knows, like, okay, if you take more than what you need, you could also be endangering the whole fleet.
And I believe it was the Quarian that is showing them around is laughing at Hendel asking these questions of, well, what if I take too much? And he goes, why would you take too much? It's, being greedy, being covetous, being a hoarder, being somebody who's gathering all those things just isn't in the Quarian mindset at all. He also makes a joke of, where would you put it? Where would you hoard things?
They're living in cubicles. There's no space. Like, even if you took it, you can't store it anywhere. So, yeah, I love these scenes because it's one of the very few instances we get an inside glimpse as to what life is like on the fleet. We don't have like this Quarian like Tally in Mass Effect 1 off of the fleet on her pilgrimage telling us what life is like on the fleet. Even in Mass Effect 2 during her loyalty mission, we don't really get to see what mundane life is like for many on the fleet.
Yeah, so it's a really great way to get to know more about the Quarians. And even Kaylee mentions that. She's like, I had preconceived notions about who they are, scavenging pack rats, outlaws of the Citadel, and it completely changed her mind.
And do you think that any of this can change Grayson's mind? Because do you think that this entire encounter, because he's seeing a lot of the same things, even though he's there for very different reasons, do you think that this leaves him with some empathy for other races?
I believe that if he had been given the opportunity to be with them and actually see this, because when Grayson gets on to the Idena, it really is a 30-minute window that he's been given to board onto the Edina with his stolen shuttle, and then he has to get to his personal shuttle that Kaylee, Jillian, and Hendel had originally taken to get back to the Edina.
The first one, the Cynead, which is a Corian shuttle, that one is rigged to explode.
Yes. So I think if Grayson had actually been afforded the opportunity, if he had been there when Jillian was walking around, seeing everything that she got to see, it might have changed his mind and his viewpoint on things. But unfortunately, he's only on the Edina for a half an hour, so he didn't get to see it.
Right. And then Grayson and Jillian actually reconnect back at the shuttle that he was going to steal, right?
Yes, because that is his original shuttle, and he was prepared to steal it back. Now, Jillian is there because she's fleeing back to the shuttle because it feels safe. And Grayson heads straight there because he thinks that that is where she will still be even all these weeks later. Jillian and crew have been talking and interacting with the Corians for about 3 weeks at this point. So it did take the elusive man and everybody a little bit of time to coordinate leaving Omega and getting to the migrant fleet.
That part escapes me. I guess it's been quite a while since I've, read or listened to the book. I didn't realize that it was a few weeks removed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't remember that part either. But now with this expanded timeline, it makes things a little bit more sense.
That's also that also means that's an extraordinary measure of hospitality from the Corians to host them for 3 weeks.
Yeah, there was actually a big part of it about it, too, about ordering in human food from the other ships and it causing a stir. There was a little bit of scuttlebutt going around, who are the new humans that are on the flotilla? Everybody was talking about it. So that was a fun and interesting part to read through also.
And if I remember right, during this sequence of time, this is one of the few times in Ascension where Jillian is talking the most. Mm-hmm. Most of the time she's silent. She's not talking.
She will talk in very flat, moderated tones and be very effective and to the point. She does not engage, isn't asking a lot of questions, and obeys orders very quickly and very easily.
Right.
Until she is with the Corians. And I really want to get into all of that about Jillian. So I think we're going to have to do a whole separate series on just Jillian Grayson.
We definitely will. So Grayson and Jillian are now in the same shuttle. Grayson's mm-hmm. there because of the surprise attack.
Yes.
So what's going on now? Is he he has now run into the target, so to speak. Is he mm-hmm. extracting her?
He wants to, but Jillian stands her ground and she tells Daddy, I won't leave without my friends. And it's the first time that she's ever talked back to him like that. And he doesn't know what to do. But Jillian won't leave, especially without Kaylee and Hendel. So what does Grayson do? Well, what any loving parent would do when their tween won't listen. He hits her with a stun gun.
Wow. What a dad. I am imagining, because you said that he only has 30 minutes before that timer goes off, right, and blows up the Cynead shuttle and scuttles the entire Edina, he's like, we don't have time to debate this. Yeah. All right, you know what? Boom. Hits her with a stunner. But what's interesting to me about this whole thing, of course, apparently he probably justifies hitting her with a stunner, as in, I'm saving her life right now. But he doesn't seem to have a problem with killing all of these Corians that he definitely saw living in relative squalor.
Again, that's the cognitive dissonance. He never leaves the shuttle. He goes directly from the Cynead onto his shuttle and doesn't kill anybody. It is all the, it is Golo and the other Cerberus agents that he brought with him on this little mini squad in order to take them all out.
Okay. So he doesn't get 3 weeks to spend there. I don't know. I still feel like once he's docked and he goes from shuttle to shuttle, he sees enough, right? Like, he knows what he's doing. He knows that he's going to kill all of these Quarians. And so I don't, for me, it's like, it reminds me of one of those people who, when you talk about real life issues, real world events, they're like, well, I don't really care as long as I can protect me and my own.
Yeah, that's exactly what that feels like. Having empathy for other people is very, very important, and not just your own species.
Not a weakness, unless, actually, there are people that cannot feel empathy, and we have a word for those. I encourage everyone to look that up. But Kaylee makes a valiant return to be the beacon of light that she is, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Because Kaylee is out there searching for Jillian while this attack is going on, because they weren't hanging out with each other in this moment when the attack started. But she finds Jillian passed out from the stunner on her father's shuttle, and Grayson is there. And she actually gets through to him. She appeals to Grayson to realize that his loyalty to Cerberus is completely misplaced, and that they're not going to turn her into the savior of humanity, as Tim has been telling Grayson, but rather to be used specifically as a weapon against the Elusive Man's enemies. Not a savior, a weapon.
Right. Well, that's kind of like, it's amazing to see the manipulation that the Elusive Man is so great at using against all of his employees, to see someone be able to break through that. And Kaylee is kind of depicted as this angel on his shoulder, and in many scenes, isn't she? Like, don't you think, do you think Grayson was starting to fall for Kaylee? Because basically every other male character that she interacts with besides Hendel ends up falling for Kaylee Sanders.
Oh, yeah, she is absolutely marketed as like the girl, the Alliance scientist next door. She's the girl next door, but everybody falls for her. But she's also kind of like the girl next door's older sister, who has a bit of a reputation, but everybody still loves her, though.
She is the Alliance scientist next door.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who's been around the block more than once.
Yeah, I guess so. This is after her courting with Anderson, though, in the first book, Mass Effect Revelation,
and the sleeping with Jiro off and on for the last 2 years. Yeah.
And but don't you feel like Grayson is starting to kind of fall for her
a little bit? I don't know if it's a fall for her or if it's just I'm starting to see that other people care for Jillian, and maybe I like you. You never know how much you love someone until you see the love they can give your child. And I think that might be what this is playing into, but I guess it's more, I didn't catch it as in like a love thing. I caught it in more of a, I appreciate what you have done for my child.
Mm. Okay, so he's starting to turn on the Elusive Man. Not like that. Not turning on the Elusive Man, but turning on him.
Turning against. Turning away from.
All right. Do you think that his addiction, Grayson's addiction, allowed him to continue, you know, like holding this styrofoam underwater about his qualms with working with Cerberus, so to speak? Like, or did his addiction drain his judgment capacity or willpower to resist the Elusive Man, to resist Cerberus? Or was it the other way around? Did he turn to Red Sand to numb himself to what he was carrying out for the Elusive Man?
I personally think it's the second one. I think that he uses it as the numbing agent, the thing to escape everything that he's done and to forget the feelings and to feel the euphoria. because it was his paranoia caused by the red sand that made him see more clearly what the elusive man was doing to him.
I can see clearly now, the sand is here. All right. Drugs are bad, okay? Don't do drugs, kids. So that kind of takes us to almost the end of Mass Effect Ascension, right? That he's starting to flip. He's no longer this loyal lapdog for the elusive man.
Yeah. Now, there are some events that happen in the aftermath of this big attack raid on the flotilla, but we leave Grayson escaping the custody of Kaylee. Now, she wakes up on the Volus world of Deleon, and Grayson has fled the area. He makes a phone call to the elusive man, a video call, not asking for help or for extraction or even to beg for forgiveness. He is sober, no bloodshot eyes, no glowy sheen, and a confident look on his face. And he has a simple statement of facts for the elusive man. He is leaving Cerberus. Jillian is beyond their reach. And stupidly, in my opinion, telling the elusive man that she is on a Quarian deep space expedition. I don't think he should have given that information up. But also, that if anything happens to Kaylee Sanders, he will go to the Alliance with all that he knows about Cerberus. The elusive man reluctantly agrees to not pursue either Kaylee or Jillian because, quote, he knows that losing Jillian will set their biotic research back a decade, but he cannot risk exposure. Cerberus has many other projects to protect.
Oh, man. So now we have this situation where Grayson is giving the elusive man an ultimatum.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about some brass cojones that this guy has, because he knows that he is taking his life into his own hands. Like, he knows that he is going to probably be on the run for life after this.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And the elusive man tries to argue, be like, do you really think that life on the run is going to be good for you and for Jillian? And he's like, you can't touch her and you can't touch me. I know too much. And it's true.
That's if like challenging the teacher that's grading your paper. Not a good idea. Like, don't get me wrong. I admire the chutzpah, but it is not a good idea to tell the elusive man you can't touch me unless your name is Commander Shepard.
Right. Yeah, I don't think that this is going to end well for Grayson. That is a huge threat to Cerberus and to the elusive man directly. So I don't think this is going to end well, but this is the end of the book. This is the last line of the book.
Right. So we see Grayson go from this compromised agent who's kind of rationalizing his own service to Cerberus, and yet his paternal instincts get in the way. His paternal instincts are the ones that are fueling not just his healing from addiction, I think, but this gradual rejection of Cerberus's methods. I think in this book, we see him start to resist out of the love he has for Jillian. And I think that he starts as this kind of messy, tragic character even, but he undergoes this transformation from reluctant participant in evil to a man who sacrifices absolutely everything to oppose it. And in so doing, he is redeeming his own actions that he carried out for Cerberus in the past. Which, in my opinion, like, just this story, even if he didn't come back in Retribution, just this story, maybe this is a hot take, but Paul Grayson has a better redemption arc than Miranda Lawson.
Ooh, that's a take. I think at this point, Yes, he has a really good redemption arc. He has accomplished what he wanted to do in getting Jillian free and away.
I think it's also probably some of my old bias coming back that it just got so annoying to hear Miranda go, "I'm perfect. Why don't you feel bad for me? Like, I have these perfect genes."
Life I'm going to do a Levi's really commercial. Life is really, really hard when you have to be perfect all the time like me, okay?
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, well, okay, well, let's talk about like what character flaws you have. Oh, I don't have any because I'm perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I know. And Yukon Cornelius here has interesting insight on Miranda that he brings up. He says that she never hated Cerberus. She just hated her dad. I would amend that because I think that eventually in Mass Effect 3, she does hate Cerberus, but it's because of what her dad brought, like, opened her eyes to. Like, her dad opened her eyes to how horrible the elusive man was, as did Shepard. Shepard also opened Miranda's eyes. But I just think that Paul Grayson's arc here in Ascension is better in terms of redemption than Miranda's, because Miranda, well, we'll get into a little bit more in Retribution, but Miranda had a much different experience telling Timmy Boy to go take a hike, and had, it was presumably safer for her, and how she was able to manipulate things. She also had a much cushier position and presumably more resources at her disposal than Grayson did, where it kind of feels like in the book, once Grayson severs that connection, that's it. Like, he has nothing. Like, absolutely zilch. And he is on the run. And he's got to go find a job. And he also sacrificed everything for his daughter, who he's never going to see again.
Yeah. Oh, that part makes me sad. I guess we know the outcomes of what happens in the next book, but our listeners may not know the whole story on that one. So it'll be interesting to cover Grayson's storyline when we record again. But next week is going to be Patreon chat, so you're going to have to wait a few more weeks to hear the conclusion of Grayson's story.
Yes, yes. And I was speaking, by the way, from his own perspective. He knows that this Corian deep space exploration mission is going to take a long time, and they might not come back. So he knows very well that this could be it. This could be goodbye for Jillian. But he wants to save her anyway. So, yeah. Yeah, we will follow up with the rest of Grayson's story, like you said, after the patron chat. But until next time, Spectres, you know, be a good parent if you are a parent. If you're not a parent, help some parents that you know, please. ask if you can do laundry or the dishes for them. They will love you forever. Anyway, that's all we got, Spectres. And I can't wait to talk with some of our patrons next week. Until next time, we should go. Thanks for listening to the Mass Effect Lorecast. Reach out to us on Blue Sky, Twitter, Discord, Patreon, or email us at masseffectlorecast@gmail.com.
Join us next week for more lore. Same space, same time. Or check out our live streams at twitch.tv/masseffectlorecast.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.